Okay, ready? The Committee on Health, Human Services, and Housing shall be in order. The date is February 13th, 2013, and please note that a quorum is present. First item on the agenda is Senate File Number 270. Senator Sharon, would you like to
thank
present?
You, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. may I just say as a general statement, the first couple of bills are my bills, and I have been in front of you before. I don't want you to think I'm the only one carrying bills in this committee. There are plenty of others coming. They've just been slow to be introduced, and many of you will have demands placed in front of you to sponsor various bills. So just be assured that you'll be seeing several other people at this table besides me. Anyway, I'm really very happy to be in front of you today. We're calling this our Mental Health Day. We're going to take a look specifically at some of the needs and talk very briefly to you about a general way about the needs that there are in our children's mental health system, the serious gaps of service that exist that create distress for families who have children with emerging symptoms of a mental illness and the lack of resources to support them. And so I'm going to ask, with your permission, Madam Chair, that Sue Abderholden from NAMI just give you a very brief overview about that. And then we have a parent with us who will be able to give you a real-life story to explain all of how in that personal life that this kind of maybe 75,000-foot discussion about what is happening in children's mental health is actually impacting a person. And then following that, we will present the bill, with your permission. And so with that, I think we'll get going. And with your permission, I introduce Sue Abderholden.
Yes, please proceed. And please state your name and title for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify this afternoon on the need to improve our children's mental health system. About 21% of children between the ages of 9 and 17 have a diagnosable mental illness or substance use disorder, but only 20% will actually receive treatment. Left untreated, it impacts their ability to do well in school, at home, and in the community. Without treatment, they are likely to face multiple suspensions, do poorly in school, drop out, end up in the juvenile justice system, become homeless, or even die by suicide. In Minnesota, in 2010, 111 people died by homicide, but 599 people died by suicide. 39 of them were between the ages of 15 and 19, and 6 were between the ages of 10 and 14. That's simply way too many deaths. Families face multiple barriers in accessing mental health treatment for their child. Insurance may not cover mental health treatment. I want to remind you that mental health parity doesn't require coverage. It just says if you cover it, you need to do it in the same way. They may have high deductibles or may not have insurance at all. If they have to go to the county for help, you need to remember that the Children's Mental Health Act requires services, but within available appropriations. And we did lose $14 million through the redirections of the Children and Community Services Act. Families face other barriers related to transportation, not being able to take off work, mistrust of the system, or long waiting lists to get in, especially to a psychiatrist. We don't have the range of options available. Parents of children experiencing serious symptoms are told that they don't meet hospital level of care and their only option is to take the child home. Schools express concern that a child is discharged from a hospital and shows up to school the next day without any support or instructions on what to do to help the child. Police are frustrated when parents refuse to take their child home from a hospital or emergency room because they can't keep the child or their family safe. And the police officers have to put a health and safety hold on the child and bring them to a shelter, and then the parents may be charged with medical neglect. We also tend to do too little, too late. If a physician told a patient that she had cancer, he wouldn't say, come back when you hit stage 4, but that's exactly what we do in the mental health system. We make people demonstrate that they are very ill and wait until they've been hospitalized numerous times before we offer just a little more. We discharge people from the hospital with a bus token, and yet none of us are supposed to drive home alone after a colonoscopy. If you want to address the problems in the adult mental health system, we need to address the problems in the children's mental health system. Roughly half of all adults who live with a serious mental illness began experiencing symptoms before the age of 14. So we know if we're going to provide early intervention and supports, we cannot wait until they are adults. The bills you are going to hear this afternoon address a variety of the barriers and problems in our children's mental health system. I hope that you're able to support these efforts to improve our children's system. We know that these bills aren't totally perfect, and as always, NAMI pledges to work with other stakeholders, counties, health plans, DHS staff, etc., to address any concerns, create a consensus, and move forward on this important issue. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before we introduce our parent who will give you a real-life experience in what Ms. Abderholden just described, I do want to acknowledge that there are very many members of this committee who have been engaged in one way or another in making proposals to improve the lives of chemically dependent and mental health persons, mentally ill persons, through the entire spectrum. So we have a series of bills here today. There will be more, probably, that we couldn't get in today. And there are other authors, and there have been historically authors serving on this committee that care very much about this issue. So I know we're all celebrating the fact that we have a day to focus specifically on mental health issues. And with that, I would very much be honored to introduce you to Jennifer Thomas, who is a parent who's going to tell us her story.
She has a handout for the PS.
And there's a handout if there is a page or someone who would be willing to make that happen.
And thank you, Ms. Thomas. And please, when you begin, please state your name and your.
Yes, my name is Jennifer Thomas. And thank you for this opportunity to share our family's story. My husband, Pete, and I are the parents of four children, adopted and biological. Two of our children are in the sixth grade, one is in the seventh, and our oldest is in eighth. Our family lives in Maple Grove. Pete is the primary income earner in our family and is a director in a multinational medical device manufacturing company. I am a former special educator but gave up my job back in 2009 when our younger son's complicated mental health needs required more care coordination and comprehensive treatment than we could both access, afford, or navigate. Pete has assumed the income earning role for our family while also providing outstanding leadership to his company. I have assumed the care managing role for our son's treatment needs and also devote time and effort to help in our community better support families of children with complex mental health needs. Together, Pete and I share the responsibilities of keeping our household and family afloat, as neither one of us could do this alone. I want to briefly tell you about our 12-year-old son, Aaron, who is currently inpatient at the hospital for symptoms related to his mental health diagnoses. I have Aaron's permission to share this information with you. As a mom, I ask that you please consider it can take a great deal of courage for a child to be open about a mental health condition. So often, Aaron is teased, targeted, and feels isolated. One of Aaron's most challenging symptoms includes having scary and negative thoughts throughout his day, which are difficult for him to understand, hard to get out of his mind, and not what his siblings or other same-age peers have to deal with like he does. He reports that these thoughts can get in the way of his ability to make and keep friends, to get along with siblings, or to trust and cooperate with adults even when they are trying to help. As a result, he reports that many times it's just too frustrating and difficult to participate in his youth bowling league, building Legos on his own, playing games with his siblings and friends, or paying attention at school. He has reported at times that he'd rather not live at home because he is afraid he might hurt his siblings if the symptoms suddenly get out of control, which they often have. He reports at times that he would rather keep these symptoms a secret because they are bad. He worries of what will happen if people know about the things that go on through his mind, and he has to rely on medications and therapy and a great deal of adult supervision and support for his treatment to be successful. Very often, he has needed specialized treatment outside of our home to include hospitalizations, residential treatment programs, day therapies, and therapeutic group home levels of care. There have been times when Aaron has needed to access or continue with one of these treatment options, but he wasn't able to. This is because there are barriers to his treatment needs, barriers that include long wait lists for treatment programs, as well as a lack of coordination among the different mental health providers, the agencies, and the funding sources that we as parents have to navigate in order to help our son. Another major barrier is that our son's treatment is not always fully funded by our private health plan or medical assistance, and Aaron's treatment and care needs are more than we can afford to pay out of pocket. As a result, Aaron's childhood has been a series of excessive transitions related to his treatment needs. His education has been adversely impacted, and his sense of self-worth has become very fragile. What would have helped us along the way is better coordination of care between the clinicians and mental health service providers. It would have helped us to have Aaron's treatment and services fully funded. It would have helped us if Aaron had easy access to mental health services within his school. It would have helped us if we could have talked with a family-to-family peer specialist who has firsthand knowledge of the daily challenges that we face trying to manage the family's overall day-to-day functioning, while we also figure out how to manage the mental health services and funding sources that are involved with our child's care. To conclude, I want to point your attention to the picture that I shared that Aaron's younger sister, Emma, drew as an in-class assignment this past fall at the start of her sixth grade year. The assignment had two steps. First, use a blank sheet of paper and draw large bubble letters to write the letters in your name. And the second step was to draw smaller images inside of the letters that tell others about who you are. Emma gave me permission to copy one portion of her letter, of her drawing, and it includes the letter E, which you have. This included her portrayal of our family. In this family picture, Emma shows her dad and Aaron's three siblings all standing behind one another in a line that I am at the front of. We are all facing in the same direction, holding on to the person in front of us in a collective effort to hold on to Aaron, who is hanging down below, at risk of falling to the bottom, her letter E. Aaron is looking sad, but he is equally holding on. For me, this drawing reminds me of what we are trying to do as a family. Stay together, not give up, and do everything we can to keep Aaron from falling further. But there are many cracks in the mental health system, and for our family, it will continue to take a great deal of effort, support, and stamina to keep all six of us from falling through. So I thank you for your time and listening to me testify today.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Thank you very much as well for that important expression of what the impact is on families for our failure to really have a comprehensive approach to children's mental health needs. And I really think this drawing is fabulous. I hope I can have permission to use it because I think it really should be a picture of the state's response to those with mental illness. And yes, we can. Yes, we can do this. So thank you for that. Okay, we're going to begin with Senate File 270, and there are several bills in front of you today that are a response to what you've just heard being described. It's not a complete response, it's not a complete resolution or solution, but it is some steps that we can take in order to be responsive to the concerns that family members have expressed to us about the needs they have in supporting family members with mental illness. And to the extent, with your permission, Madam Chair, we begin with Senate File 270.
Thank you. Please proceed.
There are a number of components of this bill that we're going to walk through with the help of Sue Abderholden and Senator Hoffman. Senator Hoffman has introduced a bill also that carries some components in his bill that are in this comprehensive bill. So I've asked him to join me at the table to describe that portion of the bill to you. So with that, I'm just going to begin, and I could go through each section, but I think I'm going to ask Sue Abderholden to do it. She really can succinctly describe each element of the bill. I can do it, but in a more clumsy way, and we have a lot on our agenda. But unique to today's hearing, I'm going to try something different. I want to make sure every member understands what each section of this bill does. So we're going to stop after each section and ask you at that time to ask clarifying questions as to anything you might wonder about that's being proposed in that section of the bill. So with your permission, we'll proceed that way for now, and then our testifiers will come later.
Please, yeah.
Thank
Please
you.
Proceed.
All right, Sue, you're on.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Section 1 is really to get at the issue of when you have someone who is having their first psychotic episode,
You want to make sure that you're using the right medication and a medication that the person can tolerate in terms of side effects. If the psychiatrist has to go through numerous prior authorizations and, you know, kind of a lot of red tape to do that, we're kind of delaying treatment. And especially with antipsychotics, people respond so differently to the medication, and they have different side effects. And, you know, frankly, we want to make sure that people who have schizophrenia are staying on their medication. And so we may end up costing, frankly, more because someone stops their medication and then is hospitalized. I do know that the health plans, and I've pledged to them that we will continue to work with them on this language. It's not perfect yet, but they're not going to testify against the bill today.
I really want to highlight the fact that we're talking about not using the formulary in this particular case, which allows, what is the problem? The problem is that if the provider, the person who's prescribing medications, is when there is a psychotic episode or any mental illness episode, you have to try a medication for a while. If it's not impacting the central nervous system in the way it needs to, then you do a shift, and you have to sometimes take some time off and put the medication back on the new so there's not the drug interaction. It's a complex process. That we want to relieve the provider, the physician, the psychiatrist, or the prescriber from having to work within the constraints of the formulary so that they can find the right treatment as rapidly as possible, because that's best practice, and not have to struggle with formulary issues. So that's what's changing here, and that's why we need to continue to have conversations with the health plan's concerns about the drug formulary. But that's the concept here, is to free this process up of prescribing medications that requires the shifts and the changes until you get the right mix of drugs to sustain a person's psychotic episode.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Sharon, or Ms. Abderholden, can you just explain what a formulary drug is? Is that just a drug that, and maybe the drugs around it, and that's all you can prescribe, and you can't go out of that box?
Senator Rosen, yes. So a drug formulary is different for each health plan. They say, here's the medications that you can take, and if you want to go outside of that, you have to require prior authorization, and you could be denied, and all of those kinds of things.
And the manager.
Senator Rosen.
Ms. Abderholden, and the reason for that strict prescription from the plans is because of the cost, or because just that's how it's been?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, it is cost, although sometimes even not all the generics are on a drug formulary. So part of it's cost, part of it's, you know, their practice and what they want to do. But they all agree that the issue related to first episode is a big one, which is why we're willing to sit down together and try to work it out.
Right. Yeah, and I would just add to that this is not just for mental health. The formulary is a way in which we're trying to establish some containment about drugs in terms of cost in the healthcare delivery system. So this is a general policy, not just for psychiatric drugs. And we're just talking about narrowing this in the very unique episode that is difficult to manage and requires subtle modifications of drugs to be, and they may need to go someplace that's outside of the formulary, and we would like some freedom to be able to do that without going through the bureaucracy.
Okay.
Any further questions on that section? All right, then we will move to section 2.
Madam Chair, members, section 2 is really about the transition of children from the children's case management system to the adult mental health system. You know, I like to say that 26 is the new 18, you know, and at 18, you know, switching necessarily to the adult system, switching your case manager, all of that kind of stuff can be, that's not the best time to do it when you're leaving high school. You want to have a smooth transition. So what we're trying to say is that if that child, you know, and of course their family, and I know at 18 that you get into data privacy stuff, but if they want to continue with their children's case manager, they can. We know that we have to look at what if they're not actually eligible for the adult mental health system. Some kids who are transitioning from the kids system to the adult system are not, and I think we actually should look at that to see, you know, are these kids that should actually go on for a couple more years until they're more stable into their adult years. I will say that I know the counties are concerned about this section, and again, we've said we will sit down with them and try to figure it out, and along with the department to figure out the funding mechanism.
I would just add to that, Madam Chair, that I want to highlight and make sure that everybody understands that the children's case management, the bar, the level of illness that you have to be at in order to be eligible for case management services is high. And then that bar to be eligible for adult mental health services is even higher. So we're talking about ill people that are on these case management services, and simply because they turn 18, especially in the management of mental illness, where anxiety plays a huge role in the breakthrough symptoms of psychosis, what we want to provide as a treatment modality is consistency, and caregiver consistency is a part of that. So what Ms. Abderholden is proposing here is to allow that case manager to continue the case management services until they move further and are more stable and out of that adolescent change, chemical changes that are going in, are more stabilized in terms of their physiology till the age of 26. And that's just critically important as a practice intervention for persons with mental illness. What the counties are concerned about is if they have to stay on children's mental health, what will be the implications of that for them as a county in terms of managing these services? And what Ms. Abderholden is telling you is that some of these people will already be on their adult case management system, but not all of them, because although the bar is high to get there in the first place, it's even higher to get into the adult mental health system. So we know some of those people would already go onto the mental health system at the adult level, so that's not going to cost the county. But there may be some that would not typically be covered by the county that would drop off at 18 and then simply be without mental health case management services. It's that group we're trying to get consistent assistance to, and we're going to work with the counties to make sure that we understand the fiscal impact on them. Are there any questions
any
on that
questions?
Section?
Regarding this section?
Okay, section 3.
Section 3?
Please. Do you want to do that one with the outreach? Or you want me to do that one?
Okay.
Madam Chair, members, the Parent Support Outreach Program is it's a outreach pilot project that really provides early intervention response to families who have significant child maltreatment risk factors. This is a good thing both for children in terms of adverse childhood experiences, and then, frankly, some of these parents also might be parents who live with a mental illness. So this is just, again, kind of early intervention and prevention.
Are there any questions? Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What qualifies as significant child maltreatment risk factors? What does that mean in real life?
Madam Chair.
And please introduce yourself to the
committee. My name is Mary Regan. I'm with the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies, and there may actually be people more able to testify in this than I am, but I'll give it a shot. Senator Nino. My understanding is the Parent Support Outreach Program is being used primarily to help families who've been screened out of the child protection system. So we have when a call is placed and a child is reported as abused or neglected, there's a screening process. And the most egregious cases are screened in for an investigation. And then those that need help but do not necessarily need an investigation are put into another track called the family assessment response. And then the third group are those that just get screened out altogether. This parent support outreach program is a program where the county contracts with community providers, and then the families are offered these services as a support for them. So that's my understanding.
So if I were to synthesize that, this is for those families that have had enough of some issue going on that the county's become involved in an assessment process, but they fall out because they don't meet certain criteria. But there may be a possibility that there's some early something happening that creates an awareness in the community of concern about the family that voluntary services offered to help them resolve some of those issues.
Senator Nino.
Madam Chair, I'm familiar with the services. I'm just wondering when we It's to serve families with significant child maltreatment risk factors. What kind of risk factors would have to exist for this to apply? That's what I was wondering.
Madam Chair, Senator Nino. The screening process that they go through identifies those risk factors. So they would be families that are reported for activity that at least rises to the level of a mandated reporter saying something bad is happening here. And then as part of the screening process, they decide, yeah, there's some things that aren't so good, but maybe with some support, this family could be helped. But we don't need to go in and actually do an official investigation. I don't know if that's any more helpful to you, and there may be other people who could.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not getting an answer that I'm looking for, but I don't want to belabor the point.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, but I appreciate the question. I think that the language draws you perhaps to trying to say that there's some list of symptoms somewhere. And it doesn't work that way. If I'm a provider and I am hearing something in a session or in a process of doing an evaluation that causes me to be concerned about the well-being of a child, I'm an obligated reporter. Mm-hmm. And that right there is the criteria. It's just that that report may go to the county and they may do a further assessment and determine it doesn't rise to the intensity level that requires the intense intervention that the county does in child protection, but could use some early intervention. So I think the language leads you to wonder if there's some checklist of symptoms, and that's not the case.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. The next two subdivisions relate to the first psychotic episode. Again, we have some research projects going on around the country, and we have someone here to testify a little bit later on the program at the University of Minnesota. But we know with the first psychotic episode, we need to be providing intensive services. These are conditions that could become disabling, but if we intervene early and with the intensity that's needed, they may not be, and that young person's their trajectory of their life may go in the right direction. What we do know is that it really helps to have medication management, psychoeducation, so they really understand what their illness is and how to help manage the symptoms, psychoeducation for the family. None of us know what to do if our loved one all of a sudden, you know, is hallucinating. I mean, none of us know how to react to that. So we need help understanding it. Care coordination, employment supports. You know, if the person is going to sit at home all day in their apartment watching daytime TV, they're never going to get better. Everyone needs something to do. And so we want to make sure that either they get some assistance finishing their education with what we call supported education, or help getting employment so that they actually have something to do every day. There's also cognitive behavioral approaches. Peer support groups is very important. We don't want these young people to be isolated. That really increases their risk in terms of violence, and so we want to keep that together. And supportive housing as well. And then the second section is to make sure that we actually do outreach and education to our healthcare and mental health care professionals so that they know how to identify some of those early warning signs of a psychotic episode and, again, be able to intervene early.
Any questions on this section? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just questioning, what are the appropriations? I just see blanks here in front of the dollar signs in Section 3 here in the first three subdivisions. And do you have numbers?
Not for all. You'll see some have a specific request and others not. So as this is placed in front of the we really don't know what the numbers are. So this is a proposal. We're going to have a fiscal analysis to determine what are the numbers, what would it cost us to actually achieve these objectives. If we think they're good policy, how much? And that's what I meant earlier when I said I'm not sure how much of this will be able to move forward or not, but it's starting to identify what interventions we need. Okay. And then we'll become maybe more restrictive, or we'll take a look at those fiscal notes and then determine how we're going to proceed from there. Thank you.
Okay. And I do have a handout for the page for the next section.
School links, yeah. The next section is Subdivision 4, School-Linked Mental Health Services.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. The School Length Mental Health Services is also known as Senate File Number 265. I'm looking at the number. School Length Mental Health Services passed in 2007, and it was a bipartisan effort that allowed school districts to get grants to mental health providers who would collaborate with schools. And since then, what we've had is it served over 13,000 children in the past several years. Those 13,000 students have accessed the mental health services through this program. For about half of those students, this was the first time they had received mental health care. And approximately half of those students were to be found in serious mental illness. What that was able to do then is to link those mental health services with the school to improve the mental health, but also success in school. Half of those kids, and this is where it relates back to the transition to age 26. As you are all aware, Minnesota is a birth mandate state. You know what that means? We provide special education services to children until their age of 22. And in this case, a transition plan that's going to be effective when they get to the adulthood is important. And this is where these all link together. Despite the overwhelmingly positive impact this program has had in the past years, there's only 17% of the Minnesota schools have had access to the school-linked mental health services. That's a vitally needed investment, and that will help thousands of Minnesota children around the state access the mental health care they need. Here's the big plus. I've spent 8 years on the largest school district in the state where we started to really realize how to access third-party payee to the point where the first year I was on the board, it was about $5,000 or $10,000. The last year, third-party, meaning getting insurance companies to pay for the medically related services. In this case, they would be medically related services. Last year, we billed MA $1.8 million. That's new money that was never found. So allowing these third-party paying to happen and get private organizations that are providing the mental health services in with the school system during the school day is also important on two other things. Number one, if your child is sent home because of an issue at school, in a sense, you're denying that child a right to a free public education. You're also, because if you're not taking schoolwork with them, so you can count out how many times kids, especially with mental health, are going to miss school. You know, are we doing the home-based services or not? I don't know. That's a different question. But the second part of this is, as a family member who is at work, they're going to get called in from work. And in my area, that accounts to about 72% of the people in our area are both mom and dad are working, or both parents are working. And so parents are getting called into the school to come and get their child to get out. They're missing their work, which is not, doesn't set up for good success both at work and at home. What this allows for a lot of individuals and what they found with the school linked mental health services is that the services can be provided to the child at the school when the child is in need of those services. That's huge. That's gigantic. It's a gigantic savings. There's a Minnesota Association of Special Educators. School special educators are around the Capitol, and I know one is in here that I've known for many years, Mary Clarkson, and she would agree with me on every one of these points about the impact that this is going to have, and it's going to be statewide. Two little things. It also, those barriers eliminates the transportation, the taking off for work, and the coordinating with school. Most of the time, as you know, if you have a doctor's appointment, it's not going to be after school. It's usually during school. So this is a well-met package, and that's about all I can say.
Thank you. Thank you. Is there any question?
Any questions about subdivision 4? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tell me a little bit more about the school-linked mental health services. What does that entail exactly, and what would that look like? And then tell me a little bit about what have the results been that you've seen in these school districts that have had access to the school-based mental health linked programs?
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I'll take a stab at the first part of it. I've asked the same question about outcomes. And it's a wonderful answers to that question that Sue Abderholden will talk about. But I think that what would it look like is if I'm a provider of mental health services in independent practice outside of the school, I would establish a contract with the state of Minnesota that would allow me to go into the school and provide this breadth of services. I also have to have a school that I would offer to provide the service in. but the contract for my services and the payment for my services is between the state of Minnesota and me as a mental health provider. Then I go to a school, and the decision on the on this distribution of these dollars, we aren't going to be able to expand it to all schools, unfortunately. We're just taking a step here. The grants to these providers will be dependent on a series of criteria, with the highest need schools being the getting the first stab at this newly expanded amount of money. So as a provider, I'm going into the school with whom I've established a working relationship to provide a series of mental health services. And I can pay for the poor, uncompensated costs out of the grant, and I can bill, as a provider does in any practice, services that I provide to somebody that has an insurance policy or self-pay component.
Can I add to that?
Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me add one component to that as well. When you're looking at the targeted, especially when you're looking at emotional behavioral disorder children, we know the cost there is coming out of special education, and you always hear the conversation about cross-subsidy in this state, right? And so what this then allows the school district, or actually the individual to do, is to bill that private insurance provider. It's, so it's, how can you not, I mean, it's a win-win. You're relieving some of the cross-subsidy issues that we're dealing with, plus you're getting supports in during the day. So it's there.
And then, Madam Chair, I'd like to have
Senator
Sue Abbott hold in.
Yes.
Just answer Senator Nelson's question about how we follow up on the outcomes of this kind of investment, why we should expand it.
Ms. Abderholen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Nelson. You know, the wonderful thing about the Children's Mental Health Division is any dollars that go out the door are tied. There's lots of strings attached. And what they want to make sure is we know exactly who's being served, how they're being referred, how much is being billed to insurance, and what the outcomes are. In your mailbox today, you were... We delivered the Mental Health Legislative Network booklet, and in there we actually have how the outcomes were improved for children. So there are assessment tools that we can use. 78% of the children improved in terms of risk of harm, 76% in terms of functional status, 70% in terms of support, and 69% in terms of resilience, which is a really, those are really good statistics. The other thing that we're able to track is how many children actually completed their treatment plans. Again, a very high percentage because we've made it easy, and if you can complete your treatment plan, you get better. And you'll hear in a little while from a testifier from Mark Sander, they've actually tracked things like suspension data and truancy data to see that we have improvements there. So unlike, you know, not all of our grants are that way, but I have to say that the ones coming out of the Children's Mental Health Division absolutely were able to track data and outcomes.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that explanation, and it looks like a very a good bill, and I appreciate each of the elements in here. I do have just one further question on the school-linked mental health services. What type of coordination, then, is there with the medical community, the rest of the medical community? Between, it's so important, I think, to have that coordination and interdisciplinary care. And what type of coordination is there then between the school-linked mental health system and then maybe the primary care physician or the rest of the medical establishment?
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, it really kind of depends on the child, if they have other medical conditions as well. Because these are done not by school employees, but by mental health providers, you know, they know how to work around HIPAA and to do that coordination. In another bill later today, you'll also see the importance of funding care coordination, which would really help in situations like that where kids have multiple issues that need to be addressed.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions about this subdivision? I just had one question. I see you've got 25% or at least 25% targeted to certain criteria. Is there? Can you talk about how you decided on those, the particular criteria, to say that, you know, we need to look for those specific areas?
Madam Chair, what we looked at were some of the kind of problems in the system. So we know that children who have in the EBD category for special education, not all of them actually even have a mental health diagnosis, and some might not be receiving any treatment at all. So where we have a lot of kids in that category, we want to make sure that treatment is accessible to them. The other issue that we certainly saw was we know that high poverty, children are more likely to have more adverse childhood experiences, which places them at greater risk for developing a mental illness. And then the third one is the high use of prone restraints in our schools, which you will, if you serve on the Education Committee, you will hear that issue later on this session. We do allow schools to use prone restraints, not the ones that restrict breathing, and they tend to be children who have very high needs. And so if we have a situation, and we had a big task force through the Department of Education, and this actually came out of there. So if you have a school that has a child where they're using prone restraints a lot, we want to be able to provide those additional resources to really look at their mental health needs so that we're not having to use prone restraints.
Thank you.
And EBD stands for Emotional Behavioral Disorder.
Are there any other questions? Okay, please proceed.
Thank you. Then we'll move to the testifiers, if
okay.
That's
yes.
Your wish.
So on the list would be Michelle. I have listed next Michelle Buckley. If you could please state your name and title for the record.
My name is Michelle Buckley. I'm a licensed associate marriage and family therapist at the University of Minnesota Psychiatry Clinic. Madam Chairman, some members of the committee, thank you very much for having me here today. Sure, thank you. First episode psychosis is often a very traumatic event in the life of a patient where a particular set of symptoms, including positive symptoms like hallucinations, delusions, paranoia, or negative symptoms like as a flat affect, flattening of emotional expression, anhedonia, which is loss of pleasure in things that they used to enjoy, lack of motivation, lack of insight into their illness, poverty of speech, and catatonia, symptoms are all present. Patients also experience often before, during, and after a first episode cognitive changes in the brain, including trouble with long-term and working memory, executive functioning, and attention. First episode psychosis often occurs in patients in their mid to late teens to early 30s, with a significant number of patients presenting during their college years. It's known to be influenced by genetic and environmental factors, but drug use has often been a contributory factor, including or especially marijuana and synthetic drugs. Approximately one-third of patients who experience a first episode will go on to never have another episode again, but first episodes have been known to lead to diagnoses of bipolar, schizophrenia, schizoaffective, and other similar disorders. We can't predict which patients will or will not go on to relapse again or if they will be the one-third that will never have another episode. But we do know that use of early intervention, consistent, frequent care, and incorporation of family psychoeducation, family therapy, and cognitive behavioral therapy for the individual will greatly increase treatment adherence and provide better long-term outcomes. First episode is particularly traumatic for young people due to significant impact on their lives when they are dealing not only with significant distressing symptoms, but they're also having their lives turned upside down at a time when they're trying to gain independence and meet life goals like getting a job or completing school. Patients are often distressed when they see their cohorts of friends continue on with their goals, as the patients are struggling with symptom management and taking time off from work and school to recover. We liken the recovery process for first episode patients being similar to that of traumatic brain injury, which can be a 1 to 2 year process to regain cognitive capabilities. Along with the patients, the families of the patients with first episode are significantly impacted, and their distress often comes from seeing their child experience these symptoms, suddenly return to their childhood home when they had left previously, and at times needing very high levels of care. Distress in families can have a negative impact on a patient's recovery if it results in high levels of expressed emotion, which consists of criticism, hostile interactions, family isolation, and unhelpful communication styles or interaction patterns. The optimal set of services we believe are necessary for treatment includes weekly outpatient medication follow-up, weekly combinations of individual cognitive behavioral therapy and family therapy, and weekly family psychoeducation groups, and also the incorporation of more family therapy and psychoeducation on inpatient units. Without special grants in place, treatment often consists of follow-ups on medication every few months after hospital discharge and may not involve family psychoeducation or family therapy that can identify and address specific cases of high expressed emotion in families. So without those weekly follow-up appointments, treatment and medication adherence significantly decline among this population, which is often due to experiences of negative side effects with antipsychotic medication, which cannot be adequately managed only every few months, and lack of insight into being sick, which therapy can immediately begin to address, and established rapport with your therapist helps with patients staying in programs even when relapse occurs. Families without psychoeducation programs or family therapy to identify specific family issues, which have often been long occurring before the episode, have trouble identifying what the psychotic symptoms are, experience caregiver burnout, and have more trouble identifying support systems in their community. This results in lower treatment adherence, high expressed emotion, and higher chances of relapse among patients. Families often need significant amounts of support during this time in help with identifying symptoms, creating relapse prevention plans, navigating the county social service programs, lowering expressed emotion levels, and learning about the cognitive declines that their child's now experienced. Families often cannot do this alone and derive significant benefit from meeting others near them that have been struggling with the same issues and can help provide support. My personal experience in providing cognitive behavioral therapy, and family psychoeducation for first episode patients at the U of M has shown me the significant need for the recommended optimal set of services I have outlined. I have directly seen the benefit of patients being able to establish a healthy rapport with all of our providers and the positive difference it's made in long-term outcomes when they have a collaborative team of providers that are all looking the best interests of not only the patient but also their family. I've been informed by both patients and their families how much they appreciate knowing that there's a team of us that want to help and have extensive training and knowledge in this field. I personally fully support all efforts placed into more training for mental health providers in this area and increased funding for more availability of family psychoeducation, family therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, and medication management. I feel that our state will be benefited by the decreased need for rehospitalization and decreased relapse rates when these services are more widely available for patients to utilize. Madam Chairman, Senators, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Next, I have listed Tim Burkett, or hopefully I'm saying.
And if Mark Zander would like to come at the same time, that would be fine.
Yeah.
I can Mark see our Zander. Time is being absorbed here, so I'm going to encourage these testifiers to not repeat what's been said and to identify their support.
Thank you. And so, Tim Burkett, please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Tim Burkett, CEO of People Incorporated. We're the largest provider of community-based services to folks with mental illness in the state of Minnesota. We provide services to in many different venues, residential venues, treatment venues, homeless, case management, crisis, and children's. And it's our belief that the most effort, the most support needs to be for children. It's pretty obvious from the testimony already today that if there's early intervention, if kids get help in school, if they get help in the homes, if they get help, if their parents get help early on, we can avoid careers of mental illness disability, and we're continuing to do it. People Incorporated served 1,000 children last year in alternative to school-based settings, where we had a half day, which they came to work with us, and then did a half day regular school. We have done case management, and we've worked a lot with parents. Young parents with mental illness are struggling to try to raise their families and having a really hard time. So I just applaud you guys for introducing these bills at a time that our resources are limited, and I think that's all I need to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And Mark Zander, would you please state your name and title for the record?
Sure. I'm Dr. Mark Zander. I'm a senior clinical psychologist with Hennepin County, and I'm also the mental health coordinator for Hennepin County and the Minneapolis Public Schools. And Madam Chair, Senators, guests, it's an honor to be here today to talk to you about school mental health, something that I'm very passionate about. To start off with, I want to share with you that I have a letter from the superintendent of the Minneapolis Public Schools expressing her support for the two bills on school mental health. So if there's anyone that wants to come and collect these, I'd be happy to leave them here. School mental health, you know, as people have already testified and discussed today, there's a lot of barriers to families and students getting access to care. Community-based services work great for a lot of families. However, for a number of our families, there's issues around child care, there's issues around transportation, there's issues around health insurance, and there's issues around keeping their jobs and time away from work to go and pick up their child, take them to a therapy appointment, take the child back to school, and then go back to work. And just think about if your child needed to go to therapy weekly and that needed to go on for 2 or 3 months, that's a lot of time away from work and also a lot of time for that student away from school. So school-based mental health and schools really already do a lot of really great work to support children and adolescents in schools through social-emotional learning and school climate and through the work of school-hired student support staff. However, typically, they're not doing clinical mental health diagnosis and treatment. And so that's really where the school-linked mental health services come in. In Minneapolis, we started in 2005 in 5 schools. Currently, we are in 21 schools across the Minneapolis Public Schools. And across Hennepin County, the School Mental Health Initiative is in over 80 schools and last year served almost 2,300 students. And like the data that was been talked about earlier, what we have found in the 8 years of collecting data on the Minneapolis Project is about 85% of the students who are identified and parents who say, yes, we're interested, are seen at least once face-to-face. 70% of them are seen within 10 days or less. Out in the community, it's 2 weeks, which is really fast, to 2 to 3 months to get in to see a therapist oftentimes. And more than half of the students, this is their very first time ever receiving mental health services. We also looked at successful engagement and treatment. For outcomes, you know, even when we're using an evidence-based practice, we need to be able to be working with those students. And our average number of face-to-face visits was 17. During one school year. And why is that important? When I was in graduate school, brief therapy was 8 to 10 visits for brief therapy. And a lot of these students, as people have referenced earlier, have serious emotional disturbances. They've got really serious mental health needs going on. We have data on both parents and teachers using the Strength and Difficulties questionnaire showing improvement in the students' mental health functioning. And also showing reductions, significant reductions in suspensions, and also increases in attendance. We've also have recent research showing a positive correlation between school mental health and standardized reading scores. I want to, you know, in closing, want to say school mental health has proven results. We know how to make school mental health work and be successful, and we ask that you support this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Senator Sharon, did you wish to? No. Okay. I have one other
Madam Chair.
Test. Oh, Senator Marty?
Quick question for Mr. Sanders. You said something about average visit in school thing is like 8 minutes, you said?
No, I'm sorry. So
what you were saying was 8 minutes.
So I'm sorry. Let me clarify. So that, you know, the average number of so when I was in graduate school, there was an evidence-based intervention called brief therapy. And for brief therapy, it was still 8 to 10 therapy visits, which doesn't seem very brief to me, but that's what it was. And so my point being that treatment takes time. And we really need to be seeing these clients ongoingly to be able to really strongly support them and integrate the successful interventions into their natural environments. Thank you very much.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did we already talk about the rural counties and the rural grants going out? Has that been discussed as far as whether it's Senate File 270 or Senate File 265? Senator Sharon. I know in on 265 here on 3.16, it talks about must distribute grants to rural or urban counties. I'm just wondering if that has been designated as what's the criteria, your thoughts going forward with this, if we can tighten this up a little bit. I know you have are targeted that can serve schools with highest percentage of special ed students in the EBD category, high poverty or high use of prone restraints. So I believe there's some discussion in that area, but I had to step out, so I'm sorry if you've already discussed this.
Senator Rosen, the question of urban-rural has not been raised.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, you know, they have been distributed pretty well throughout the state when you look at the map. Obviously, there are some pockets, including in the metro area, where schools have not been have not received grants. What we wanted to do is just to make it clear that we really do want to cover the whole state, and we wanted to kind of upfront address the issue of someone saying, well, you know, the metro area gets all the money and not the rural area, and we just, so there isn't a, you know, necessarily a percentage or anything like that, but just wanted to reassure people like you that we really are going to make sure that it goes statewide.
Madam Chair.
Another question?
Well, I appreciate that, Ms. Afterholden, because 4 out of my 7 counties do not have anything. And obviously, it's they can fit any of these criteria. So perhaps we can take a look at a little more comfort language, or I'm not sure if you want to put a percentage or if every – I'm not sure, but I would like to work with the author on that.
Senator Sharon?
I would just like to ask Senator Rosen if you would be willing to answer a question, Senator Rosen. Did you say, did I understand you to say that you believe in the 4 counties in your district that they would meet the criteria as listed here in terms of behavioral disruptions or income limitations? I thought I heard you say that they would meet that criteria.
Senator Rosen?
Madam Chair, thank you. Senator Sharon, I think they would. Blue Earth County doesn't have one, and I would
understand.
Assume.
I understand, but I think that that we were trying to focus this on high need areas rather than urban and rural. So, if the distribution so far with the limited amount of money that we've had so far has been rural and urban, that we can expect that it would continue that way. But I think that when we have limited resources, we're trying to target it towards the high need population as best we can, where the highest need is. We can have the biggest impact.
Mm-hmm. Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair. And Senator Sharon, don't get me wrong. I think this is a great program, and I'm very ready to support this program. But I do remember an exchange from a fellow senator years ago that said that there are greater needs in the metro area than what you have out in greater Minnesota with your children. And I found that almost offensive because we may have a smaller population and a number of children, but there are children out there that have significant needs. And I'm not sure what the criteria is for being able to receive a grant. And that's probably something that can maybe button down a little bit better.
Ms. Afterholden.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I did just double check, and in order to receive a grant, you have to apply, and in your counties, they did not apply. So hopefully with the increased funding and encouragement, they would apply the next time around.
And Madam
Senator
Chair.
Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Afterholden, I'm going to make sure that school districts know about the program, because I know it's been funded for a while, but I actually, and I'm almost embarrassed to state it, was excited about it when I saw it in the governor's budget. Was not familiar with this program, and I'm so, you know, wondering about some of these small school districts that have small administration, and I wonder how much they are aware of these grants. So that there's just a lot of unknowns here.
Ms. Afterholden.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, it's actually the community mental health provider that applies. Because we want it to be the, you know, you know, we want to separate out healthcare and educational records. So it's your community mental health provider that you might want to go talk to make sure that they apply.
Okay.
And Senator
Madam
Rosen.
Madam Chair, thank you. And Ms. Afterholden, do they have a relationship then with the school district? The school district has to tell them to apply, or How does that work? I mean, there's a lack of communication maybe, or I'm not sure. There seems to be a...
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, it is a collaboration, so they have to say, yes, we have, you know, these school districts willing to collaborate with us. Okay. So I don't know, you know, whether they couldn't get a school district to collaborate with them or they decided not to apply at that point of time because they weren't sure they had enough personnel. I have no idea. But we can go back and kind of find out a little bit more if you'd like.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Sharon.
If there are no further questions, I would move that...
Excuse me. I'm sorry. There's one other. I had one other testifier listed. Stacy Hannon. Is that okay? Can you state your name and your title, please?
I'm Stacy Hannon, the Grant County Social Services Director, and I'm here today as the chair of the Children's Committee with the Minnesota Association of County Social Services Administrators. First, we want to commend the authors of the bill for addressing many of the issues that counties also find important and we would give support to. We support the expansion of the Parent Support Outreach Program, and actually I can answer questions on the Parent Support Outreach Program if there are questions when I'm done. We are pleased to see interest in forwarding services to youth that would extend past age 18. We know that there's a growing concern about the need for services that support homeless and disconnected youth, particularly those subject to sexual exploitation. That noted, however, there are some questions about whether this statute change is necessary to improve access for all young adults with mental health concerns. There are already laws to see that these needed services are delivered, and we're concerned that this legislation could result in an expansion of a mandate without funding to support it. We see the value of many of the items in the bills, and we want to work collaboratively with the author as well as with the department to implement these if they're enacted into legislation. First, I can give a little bit of background. Targeted case management, whether it be child or adult, is not a direct therapy service. It's a service that assists people in attaining appropriate services to meet their mental health needs. So coordination of care and services is what it does. The goal for targeted case management is to make certain people access services to keep themselves healthy and independent and as independent as possible. The children's mental health system is predicated on parents still having responsibility for their children's care and supervision. The adult system, however, is based on maximizing independent living in the community, an appropriate perspective that creates a different portfolio of services in the children's world. In the adult world, they provide services like medication monitoring, housing, employment, budgeting, and things that will assist the client in being successful in the adult world. We have staff who are experts on those services, but they're in the adult mental health world, and they are adult mental health case managers. The statute already allows for these youth to transition into the adult system. Additional language in this area isn't really necessary to allow continued support. We have some questions about legislation that would treat adults within a case management system designed and operated based on the needs and the rights of juveniles and children. Currently, to serve a young adult up to the age of 21, because you can currently serve them up to the age of 21 in the children's mental health system. However, they need to have been served previously at the age of 18 in the children's mental health system. We have spoken to the author, and we understand that the qualification would be the same for this proposal, but we would appreciate that the language be clear on that issue. Without the clarity, there is the potential of opening up an entirely new population to counties, and I think that's a broader issue and it would require some time for us to assess the impact for counties. The language currently in the draft indicates that services must continue past age 18 if requested by the child or the child's family. We're concerned about the ability for a family to request services to continue when a young adult may have a different choice. We do not ordinarily take choice away from adults without a court process. So though these clients are adults, since these clients are adults, we want to ensure that they're in charge of their own care to enhance independence and self-direction of care. We acknowledge that there are differences in eligibility criteria between children's mental health and the adult mental health system. There are many more diagnoses that qualify a child for children's mental health targeted case management. In the adult mental health world, there's about 6 to 8 diagnoses that qualify them as being seriously and persistently mentally ill. So, as a result, we do have children's mental health clients that age out of the system at 21 and may qualify for transitional services but may not qualify for ongoing adult mental health services. If we were to mandate mental health case management services for young adults ages 21 to 26 who are not seriously and persistently mentally ill, additional funding would need to be considered or dedicated to that. The differences in eligibility criteria do create a gap in access. We see the gap in the system, and we agree that it creates issues for young adults who are not seriously and persistently mentally ill. This language puts the county as the only party responsible for this gap. Changing the system of service for adult mental health is a broader issue that requires more collaboration with entities just beyond just counties. In closing, the counties agree with many of the services proposed in this bill, and we would like to move forward in those services as we agree that they're in the best interest of children and families. It's important to focus on preventative services, and we feel this bill does so by supporting the parent support outreach, school-linked mental health, and important training. We have questions around the expansion of case management from 21 to 26 and feel that more work needs to be done on the issue before moving forward. We would be happy to work with the department and the author on the issue, but we'd also like the legislature to consider the financial implications of this bill and consider uncompensated and undercompensated care that will come with this population. But the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators would like to be a part of this solution. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other questions, further questions or discussion regarding this bill?
Okay, I just don't want that to drop flat in front of the committee. You heard Ms. Abderholden say in her opening remarks, if you weren't here at that time, that these issues have been presented to us of concerns. We think some is a misunderstanding of what is meant in the language and that we can clarify that, and that there will be ongoing conversations with the counties about this section of the bill, including an analysis of what the implications of the bill are for counties. So I've heard this testimony, and as we move forward, we will take a look at that.
Any other questions? Hearing no further discussion, the question is on the motion of Senator Sharon that Senate File 270 be recommended to pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Preferred to finance.
Thank you.
Oh, and yes, and the motion prevails. The bill is recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. So, all right, thank you.
Thank you.
And now moving on to Senate File number 265.
Thank you. I think that we'll present the entire bill this time and see how that goes. I realize that our time is tight here, so we will proceed with Senate File 265. I'll ask Sue Abderholden as well to move through the sections and to explain them to you, and then answer your questions if you do not understand the essence of what's in the bill after that.
Madam Chair, members, we've already talked about Section 1, so I'm going to skip over.
Oh, excuse me. There is an amendment. I'm sorry. I have an amendment.
Sorry.
I was on the wrong page.
With your indulgence, I would like to offer the A1 amendment.
Please.
The A1 amendment, by way of explanation, as it's being distributed, simply removes from Senate File 265 duplicative language that is in 265 that already is... It has been passed by this committee in 270. So we're removing repetitious language in 265 from that is already in 270. And then there's some cleanup language.
Is there any discussion regarding the A1 amendment? Hearing none, the question is on the motion of Senator Sharon that Senate File number 270 be, or, excuse me, 265 be amended as shown in the document labeled A1. All those, let's see, we have to vote them. Yes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Thank you. And now we'll describe the bill.
Thank you.
As amended.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the first section then is on child and adolescent behavioral health services. This is actually currently a facility in Willmar, Minnesota. It's supposed to be our safety net for children with serious mental illnesses. It's a small program. We think that, you know, we need to use all of our resources as wisely as possible. So we'd like to do is to pull together people to really look at what is the role of our state-operated services in terms of serving children, making sure that we're meeting the needs of kids with all of these kind of more difficult illnesses, including kids who also have autism, spectrum disorders, reactive attachment, co-occurring with a developmental disability, et cetera.
making sure that we can have qualified staff actually be in these programs. To be honest, sometimes it's difficult in Willmar to attract the people that you need who have, you know, are really highly skilled and trained. We might need more than one facility. We're not sure, but we want to bring people together to say, we have kids where we have nowhere for them to go. They sometimes end up out of state, and we need to think about what we can do in Minnesota on that issue. The next one is psychiatric residential treatment facility licensure. We currently don't have those types of programs in Minnesota. We do have some residential facilities who would be willing to step up to that level. Again, it's a more intensive level of care, but we need to have input into actually developing the standards. And then the next section is the first one is on children's mental health crisis services. These are mobile crisis teams that can, instead of a child going to the emergency room or a hospital, the crisis team can come out, assess, they can do some stabilization services. We currently have 18 crisis teams covering 59 counties, and one tribe. And, you know, we'd really like to have this statewide. Again, it's a very much of a cost saver. Mental health first aid training is the next one. We currently provide mental health first aid training for adults, which Senator Laurie knows very well, and it's been a very successful program around the state for sometimes in rural areas for police officers, librarians, anyone who comes into contact to understand mental illness and what to do in a crisis. There is a brand new program now that's available for mental health crisis for youth, and so we'd like to be able to teach that for teachers, school resource officers, juvenile justice folks as well. The next one is respite care. We've had previous grants from 2007 funding respite care. We've not been able to serve all the counties that would request it. Respite care is where a family can take a break. I actually have a foster care license and can take kids into my home on a weekend. Parent comes on Friday, drops their kid off. They look awful. They're stressed. They're tired. They have some time to kind of recharge their batteries, maybe see their other kids, have a date, you know, something like that. They come back on Sunday, and they just feel like they can go at this again. And then the last one is community health workers. You might remember the legislature 2 years ago allowed community health workers to operate under the supervision of a mental health professional. Community health workers are great in terms of reducing healthcare disparities, but a lot of the community health workers are saying we don't really have training, so we're not really sure what to do in the mental health area. There is a national training program out of the National Council of Behavioral Health, and so we'd like to bring that training here so that we can actually have community health workers work in the mental health field. Thank
you. That completes the description of the legislation. Is there anybody that has any clarifying questions about the contents of the bill or the meaning of any of these sections?
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is Subdivision 5 the bill that we just passed?
Yes. An amendment that we just passed removed that language with Section 1 because it was duplicative.
Thank you. I missed that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, thank you. Senator Sharon, since this is the policy, the Section 4 Subdivision 2, the $45,000, and then the respite care, and then the community health worker training dollars, that this is for continuing education on mental illness for children and adults, and how do they go about? I mean, I know it's not a lot of money, but is there continuing ed hours that they have, and that's how they're going to do this?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, on the mental health first aid training for adults, some people can get it. They get a certificate after the 2 days, but a lot of them just feel like it really helps them in their position. Libraries often have people with serious mental illnesses come in. They don't know how to deal with them, and so this has really helped them a lot. And in the rural areas where you can't attend the full 40-hour CIT training for police officers, crisis intervention team training, this is at least a good step for them in kind of understanding mental illnesses better. We know it's not a very expensive program, the $45,000 is really to train the trainers, so you get a team of people who can then in Minnesota provide that training.
Okay.
Any further questions? No. Senator Laurie.
I did help kind of craft this, and NAMI took it on and did a lot of fantastic work, and kind of one of the things that the stories that always reminded me is, you know, we have all these CPR trainers, are trained individuals who are ready to respond to heart attacks. And, you know, I mean, honestly, members of our community that are interacting with our friends and our neighbors are much, much, much more likely to come in contact with people that are suffering from serious mental illness that also are of life-threatening dimension. And we had, you know, nothing really to for community members that are interacting with individuals to help have the skills to be able to respond appropriately and just be a good ear, be a good voice in directing them in a positive direction to help improve their lives. And it is a train-the-trainer model, so usually it's just a little bit of seed money to get this network out there, and it really has been demonstrated through evidence to be incredibly effective and just help important community members recognize and understand and be helpful when they come in contact with individuals experiencing mental health issues. So I'm really like this small piece.
Thank you. Any further discussion?
We can proceed with our testifiers.
Yeah. Oh.
Do we have any?
Do we have? Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, Tricia Stark. I'm sorry, I didn't see the name. I'd like to call Tricia Stark to testify.
Hello.
Hi.
My name is Dr. Tricia Stark. I'm a licensed psychologist and legislative chair for the Minnesota Psychological Association. And hopefully I won't go over parts of the bill that are in the other bill and have been removed. A community discussion about state-operated services, CAB services, children and adolescent behavioral health, is long overdue, and hopefully the bill can provide needed impetus to change. And I can say this because some other people can't. A frank discussion about the location of the program is also needed, where it can best serve the most children with convenient access to the family and community to which the child will return. Minnesota needs a premier program that can effectively treat our children and adolescents with the most challenging and specialized needs. You heard before about school-linked mental health services, and I just want to add one piece that wasn't talked about. One study looked at the economic benefits for a group of students who were at risk for out-of-school placement. And they found a savings of $31,826 per student per year for the in-school, school-linked mental health programming. First aid training and training community health providers will increase awareness, reduce stigma, and enhance the social capital of the community to deal with mental illness. And you've heard about mental health first aid training and how helpful it is. It will result in a public that better understands and supports young people dealing with serious mental health concerns. And providing training about mental illness to community health workers will begin to address disparities in health outcomes. Community health workers are part of the fabric of diverse communities and are uniquely qualified to address the cultural concerns that may interfere in securing timely access to mental health. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Is there any further discussion? Hearing no other discussion, the question is on the motion of Senator Sharon that Senate File 265, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion prevails. The bill is recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Senator Lori, welcome to the committee as a presenter. Senate File 264.
Yes, actually, to begin, I have a couple of author's amendments just to put the bill in shape, if members would. The first one is the A1 amendment. It's technical. It's to really make sure that the definitions are in alphabetic order. That's all that one does. So I'd move the A1 amendment.
Has the A1 amendment been distributed?
Certainly can be. I'm going to move the A2 amendment as well and the A3 afterwards, and staff can distribute those as well, but they're also not controversial.
Okay, thank you. Senator Lori has moved the amendment labeled A1. Is there any discussion? Is there anything that you'd like to say? This is a technical amendment?
It's incredibly technical. It corrects the definition so that they're in alphabetical order.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Would you be willing to answer, on page 1 under 1.19, what page line 16, strike J and insert means?
Yeah. Tomorrow.
No, I'm just kidding.
We'll get that information.
We're going to have some testimony on that line. All right. Hearing no discussion, all those in favor of the amendment say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment A1 passes.
The A2 is also technical, just cleaning up a couple of things. Staff gave this to me, council did, and it's just cleaning up the intent of we're okay. Going after.
Senator Lori moves the A2 amendment. Are there any questions or discussion?
It's incredibly.
Are there any testifiers wishing to speak on this amendment? Is everyone ready? No questions. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A2 amendment passes, and the A3 amendment.
The A3 amendment as well, and this is replacing Section 2. It's really and then I'll just describe Section 2 when we get to the, so it's an author's amendment. It's a reformation that stakeholders have worked on, and seems to meet the intent a little better than the original drafting of it, so I'd offer that as an author's amendment too, but it doesn't really change what Section 2 does. It's a recrafting of it, and that can just be more efficient as members read the bill. They can go right to what we meant.
Okay, thank you. Senator Lori has moved the amendment labeled A3. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment A3 passes. Senator Lori.
In shape to carry it forward, and I appreciate the members' support in getting those amendments adopted. And Senate File 264 is really some significant improvements for children's mental health services covered by medical assistance or Medicaid. It fills some significant gaps in services and supports for our children who are struggling today. There's provisions to improve care coordination, case management, and in-reach community-based service coordination that really will improve the continuity of clinical and community supports for these youth. And the addition of a family psychoeducation service is critical to make sure that families that are caring for these children get the help to understand and really support their children's treatment needs and their skill development for is it lifelong success. I get this thing wrong every time. All right, I'm sorry. Directly into it. All right. So that's overarching summary of the bill. I'll step through each section. Section 1 clarifies that school districts are not liable for payment for mental health services. Really, this section is needed to help assure school personnel that referrals for evaluations and assessments of suspected mental health concerns, just like referrals for physical health concerns, will not result in costs for schools. There's been a history of some uncertainty around that, and because of that uncertainty, a reluctance at times for school districts to actually appropriately refer when they see needs. Section 2 directs the Commissioner of Human Services to conduct a survey of mental health and pediatric service providers, modeled on the survey that CMS at the Feds conducts to evaluate Medicare vendors. And this is really designed to help inform decisions regarding contracts with managed care entities by providing information from providers on efficiency of authorization and utilization review practices, consistent with the goals of access to appropriate services for clients and accurate and timely payment and oversight of providers. And then there's several new mental health services expanded, defined, and funded in the following sections. Section 3 is family peer specialists, and this would provide support for training and certification of families and allow providers to hire and bill for certified family peer specialists to provide support for and assist in the real engagement of families. You'll see a long list in there of the program model, which provides for non-clinical family peer support counseling, building on the strengths of families and helping them to achieve the desired outcomes, make sure it collaborates with others providing care and supports to the family, provides non-adversarial advocacy, promotes the individual family culture and the treatment milieu, links parents to other parents in the community, offers support and encouragement, and assists parents in developing coping mechanisms and problem-solving skills, promotes resiliency, self-advocacy, development of the natural supports, and maintenance of skills learned in other support services, establishes and provides peer-led parent support groups, and increases the child's ability to function better within the child's home, school, and community by educating parents on community resources and assisting them with problem-solving and educating parents on mental illness. And these are critical skills in really, again, helping families wrap around the needs of the children that are struggling. Section 4 expands in-reach community-based service coordination to an inpatient psych unit, residential treatment center, community mental health center, CTSS provider, or juvenile justice facility for a child with serious emotional disturbance and for young adults up to age 26. The purpose of this section is to connect children with serious emotional disturbances to existing services in the community in order to facilitate transition and ensure appropriate services throughout. And this is currently being worked on for adults, and this change for children was recommended by a work group looking at ways to reduce repeat hospitalizations and reduce the use of ERs. Section 5 is the family psychoeducation and the Medicaid service. And this supports providers' time spent with families, explaining the specific characteristics and symptoms of their child's mental illness, the skill development plan, and the treatment options available to support recovery for these youth. Section 6 is the clinical care consultation, which allows mental health professionals to bill for time spent consulting with other care professionals. It's critical to integrating physical and mental health care. The clinical consultation benefit also supports consultation with other mental health professionals to ensure communication and a shared treatment planning. And Section 7 defines care coordination and assessment within the Children's Therapeutic Service and Supports package, that's the CTSS package, of services available to emotionally disturbed children and adolescents. And it also addresses care coordination to allow for CTSS providers to bill for the time spent coordinating care with other significant entities, including participation in the individual education planning meetings, the IEP meetings at the schools, coordinating multidisciplinary work with shared clients, and supporting ongoing treatment planning and service coordination. These new services, along with the clinical care consultation, will help avoid duplication of effort and allow for shared understanding of the client's functioning and treatment needs. And Section 8 adds these new services to the list of MA-covered service components for CTSS providers. That is a walkthrough of the bill, and would stand for questions, or I think there's a couple of testifiers. Whatever.
Would you like us to proceed with the testifiers, or are there questions at this time from clarifying questions from the committee on the contents of the bill? None. Okay, seeing none, Senator Lurie, I think we'll proceed with Mary Regan, who would like to approach. You're looking at each other. Is there a question about whether or not you were going to testify again, Mary?
Thank you, Madam Chair. No question, just not sure there's a need. The next testifier, I think, could give you some very specific examples of how this could work. So I would encourage you to skip me and go to her.
Thank you, Mary. I appreciate that. Is this Peg Hayes?
Yes.
Hello, Peg. Introduce yourself and orient us to who you are, and please address the committee.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to speak today on Senate File 264. As you heard, I'm Peg Hayes, Director of Children's Mental Health at the Amherst H. Wilder Foundation in St. Paul. We're a community mental health clinic that serves primarily low-income, culturally diverse children and their families. And we've been in this business for quite a while, since 1926, having started one of the first children's mental health clinics in the country. I'm here today to endorse particularly the legislation related to mental health care coordination, and I'm going to speak more specifically about the clinical case consultation and the needs for this. As you've heard, children's mental health services are in dangerously short supply, and part of that is due to the low reimbursement rates in this area and underfunding that's been historical. These two pieces would help support the activities of children's mental health providers significantly. I'll give you a scenario that illustrates how clinical case consultation was helpful to a teenager and her family. A psychologist met with Anna, who was 14, and her father for an initial assessment. Father was explaining the situation through an interpreter, and he said that his daughter had cut her wrist the evening before. He had learned about this through a call from a school social worker who Anna had told about the act of self-harm. When the psychologist talked with Anna, she also learned that Anna had taken an undisclosed amount of Tylenol. And this is significant in that Tylenol is one of those over-the-counter medications that can cause liver damage, and in a high enough amount can be fatal. So Anna was not only psychiatrically at risk, but medically at risk. So we knew that she needed to be assessed at an urgent care or hospital, and because of her significant depressive symptoms, probably looking at hospitalization to stabilize her. The father also said he had no family in the area, had limited resources, and he was concerned about the safety of his child over the weekend, and Anna felt she couldn't promise to not do another action to hurt herself over the weekend. The dad agreed to take his daughter to a hospital ER for assessment, and the psychologist called ahead, knowing that the father's limited English may make the complicated symptoms not be expressed that well. In doing that, this was one of those times that happens where that hospital's adolescent beds were full. They were full in all of the metro area and probably in the state. So the psychologist also worked with a community crisis outreach worker to find out if there was a possibility of doing a crisis plan over the weekend if she were not admitted, and also talked about a plan of getting her into a regular hospital bed until an adolescent unit opened up. The psychologist then spent time with the triage nurse for the family's insurance company. They were fortunate to have coverage, and was able to explain the breadth of situations and the depth of the seriousness of the situation. The girl was admitted, and there was a good outcome to this. But all of that time spent on the phone with numerous providers in the community is currently unreimbursed. It was approximately an hour and a half of the psychologist's time. This is not an uncommon scenario in the world of children's mental health. Case consultation happens across a broad range of things, not just in initial appointments and assessments. And what we've seen is, especially if we're doing school-based work, over 20% of a provider's time can be spent in case consultation with a number of providers that children are seeing. I see this as critical to keep the system basically afloat and improve access for kids, and can also certainly decrease duplication of services, reducing cost. And when providers are consulting across the range of providers, and sometimes there's 7 or 8, in a child's life with serious mental health, the outcomes are improved as diagnoses are clarified, treatment interventions that work are identified. The child and the family are feeling safer, less stressed, and feeling like care is going in one direction instead of getting multiple conflicting recommendations. So I urge you to support adding case consultation and the care coordination that's specific to the rehab services to the Children's Mental Health Benefits Set. And hopefully this will be considered, and I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on Senate File 264? Thank you. Are there any questions? There are no questions? Wow.
I move that Senate File 264, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
You've heard the motion. Is there any further discussion? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Loria, but this is the first time we're using the word milieu in statute.
I actually worried about it when I was preparing, and then I forgot about it to prepare and try it one more time. But, no, I think – I don't milieu. Know if I said it right or not, but yeah. Milieu something.
It works.
The question is whether or not this room is a therapeutic milieu or not. That's the real question.
That's not been my history.
Okay. You have heard the motion. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Senator Lori. Next is Senate File 266. Senator Eden. Senator Eden, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have Senate File 266, and essentially it addresses the concern that we have about the shortage of Level 2 mental health behavioral health aides and some of the issues surrounding getting people trained for that position. And I'll have Susan speak
Susan,
to that.
Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The community health work, we modeled this after the community health workers. So what the community health workers did is they, working with MNSCU, is that they developed an 11-credit certification program. So they can go, they can get their certificate, and then they can go get hired. Right now, Level 2 behavioral health aides are actually trained by the provider, which makes it difficult. You got to find someone, then you have to train them, and what if they leave and go somewhere else? You've invested that time and money in them. And this way, they can go to a local college, they can do the training course, and then they can go apply to whatever program is out there. We're really trying to create kind of ladders, if you will, so that people can become, you know, more professional and, you know, have this certificate program so they can get hired by children's mental health providers. So we think it's just one of those small steps to bringing more people into the workforce.
Senator Eden or Ms. Abderholden, who are these people and where would they be employed?
Madam Chair, they would be employed. Some of them could be, it could be a lot of different folks, actually. In a Level 2 program, they have to at least be 18 years old. They could have an associate or bachelor's degree, or they could complete the certificate program. So this would be an option for some people. They would most likely be employed with Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports as a way to work with families and children.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Abderholden. In step with the community paramedic bill that just passed through, is this going to be any conflict of other responsibilities from other groups, people doing the same job requirement? Is this the certificate? Just asking if there was...
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, not that I know of. Okay. We've not been contacted by anybody worried about this.
Senator Rosen.
Senator Eden.
Thank you. This is already a certification of an existing level of health professional, so it shouldn't be an issue in this case.
Okay.
Senator Rosen, any follow-up? No, Senator Marty, and then Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, Senator Eaton, in other words, these are people already doing this work, but they have to be certified but they're basically trained on the job. In effect, we'd be setting up a way that they could get trained so they could apply to any employer rather than that.
That is correct.
That is correct. Okay, thank you. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Eaton and Ms. Aberholden. I'm looking at page 2, section 2, subdivision 8A. The 11 credit certificate program, it just seems very specific. So was this modeled after something that had gone before, an expansion of another form of service or a certification process? So if you could enlighten us on that.
Ms. Aberholden?
Senator Benson, we modeled it after community health workers and, you know, looked at what they did with the health department and the community colleges, and they created the certification program so people could get the education and then go be hired by, you know, any community health clinic or whatever.
Thank you. And
Senator Benson?
Madam Chair, do we want to be specific as to the 11 credits? I always get worried when we stick things, when we stick a certain number in, if the department would decide differently, they have to come back to statute. So I'm not suggesting an amendment. I'm asking Ms. Aberholden as the expert on this process.
Ms. Aberholden.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, we actually took the community health workers have 11 credits, and so we thought, well, if they figured it out ahead of us, we would just steal directly from them. There's no other kind of rhyme or reason. We just saw that they did 11 credits and thought that, you know, probably made sense.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you. Just to follow up on that, Ms. Aberholden, I think the essence of the question is, do you need to say the number of credits in case in the design of it you'd like to add it to 12 credits or 10 credits?
Madam Chair, I have no... you know, strong commitment to keeping it 11. If we wanted to eliminate that to provide more flexibility, I'd be just fine with that.
Maybe we can continue to consider that. Senator Benson, you wanted to suggest something? Senator Nina?
I just was suggesting if you want to afford some flexibility on that, you could change that language to not fewer than 11. That would give you upward flexibility.
Yeah. Is that an amendment? Verbal amendment? Yeah. Senator Nino?
Madam Chair, if that's amenable to the author, I guess I can offer up that language.
So I'll just make sure that, Ms. White, do you want to articulate where we would place that in our bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. And 11 credits. On page 2, line 20. Delete an 11 credit and insert A. And after program, insert of not fewer than 11 credits. So the sentence would read, shall develop a certificate program of not fewer than 11 credits for level 2 mental health behavioral aids.
Senator Nienau has moved this amendment. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment passes. Is there any further questions or discussion on the bill? Hearing none, the question is on the motion of Senator Eaton. Just one blank. Eakin Eaton. Senator Eaton, that Senate File 266 as amended pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? Hearing none. The motion passes. Thank you very much, Senator. There is no business, no further business in front of this committee, so the meeting shall adjourn. Thank you very much to all our testifiers. Better go get my license.